I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:19. Members present are Representatives Carrick, Cologne, Burt, Field, Sadler, and Nelson. We have a lot of bills today. HB 138, Behavioral Health Surcharge, House Bill 156, Wage Information, House Bill 178, Medical Debt Information, HB 110, Social Work Licensure Compact, and SB 54. So first up, House Bill 138, Behavioral Health Surcharge, by Representative Mina. Representative Mina and Ms. Giorgio, thank you for being here. I think the plan is to go straight to invited testimony. First up in invited testimony is Susanna Marchuk. Ms. Marchuk, would you like to proceed?
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to testify on House Bill 138. Again, my name is Susanna Marchuk, and I am the Executive Director of Caroline Crisis Services, what many often refer to as the Alaska Caroline. Caroline is Alaska's 988 call center, a front line of defense in Alaska's crisis care system for over 20 years. Caroline offers a free 24/7 statewide resource for Alaska's most vulnerable, providing support for those in need of someone to talk to and facilitating intervention and support for individuals contemplating suicide. Caroline facilitated just shy of 40,000 crisis contacts last year, which is a threefold increase in lifeline calls since the launch of 988 in 2022. Caroline is staffed by Alaskans for Alaskans, understanding that Alaska-based crisis counselors are uniquely equipped to navigate the literal and figurative landscape of accessing care in our great state. As Caroline has expanded, we have continually solicited feedback from statewide stakeholders to ensure that our services are responsive to the needs of those we support. A factor that stakeholders have emphasized of importance is that the call center not outsource staffing, a commonly utilized staffing solution for other call centers. Okay. Caroline employs a team of 38, all based in Alaska. We have two locations, with our main office located in Fairbanks and a satellite office, which was opened in the fall of 2023, located in Wasilla. 988 Lifeline member centers like Caroline are required to be accredited, to provide evidence-based training for counselors, and to adhere to nationally and internationally recognized standards and best practices for crisis call centers. Caroline Crisis Line counselors complete robust training on assessing and responding to suicide risk to include engaging trusted support or regional providers as appropriate. Staff offer follow-up calls to all calls with a crisis component. These follow-up contacts offer additional opportunities for the team to provide ongoing safety screening and support. 98% of the calls received in our call center are resolved within the call center, reducing the burden on our 911 and law enforcement partners. As the state has advanced its efforts to build out the care continuum, Caroline and 988 have been a cornerstone of those efforts. In addition to expanding access to crisis call services, we have thoughtfully and intentionally built and expanded relationships with our crisis care partners, engaging collaboratively in this work with our 911 partners, by developing a direct mechanism for 911 call transfers, working with our tribal health partners to ensure that the care provided by our team is culturally informed, providing contractual support for regional crisis lines to sustain regional resources and provide continuity of care, and developing pathways to facilitate mobile crisis team response, to name a few. As demand for crisis response services like Caroline continue to grow, the funding solution presented in House Bill 138 comes at a critical juncture for the state. HB 138 is a lifeline. By passing this bill, you guarantee that no Alaskan faces a crisis alone and that our rapidly expanding crisis care network keeps moving forward. Thank you to the chair and the committee members for your time. I'm available for any follow-up questions you may have.
Representative Sadler does have a question, Ms. Marchuk.
Thank you, Ms. Marchuk. Sure. Through the chair, appreciate your involvement in stepping up the 988 system in Alaska. I've got a couple of questions. I'm not especially familiar with the system, but that's not really the point now. But a quick question, in your experience working with others, you said that I think there are many other states that also have similar programs. Do any of those use funding mechanisms to provide funding for the fairly broad range of services that this bill would have 988 charges fund? Do other states fund services other than the bare costs of the system, the call system?
Through the chair, I don't feel like I'm informed enough to speak on how other states that have implemented a similar fee are supporting crisis services in their state.
And I respect that. The other question, is there any call switching between people that might call 911 and really should have called 988? Is there an easy function for people to swap calls back and forth between those two systems?
Yes. So through the chair, I would say that if we can toot our horn a little bit, that the state of Alaska has been really innovative in how we've built continuity of care between our 911 and 988 call centers. We actually were, there at the front figuring out how do we work collaboratively to ensure that if people contacted 911, but what they really needed was 988, how do we make that connectivity? And so what we built was a direct back line, and we built the programming for that line with input from our 911 partners so that they could efficiently connect those folks who don't need law enforcement, who don't need EMS, they don't need a fire response, but what they need is someone to talk to. So our 911 dispatcher partners have the opportunity to directly transfer those calls into our center.
Thank you, Ms. Marchuk. Representative Colom has a question.
Yes. Hi. So I'm trying to, I'm trying to follow the money. So initially, 988 sounds like it was set up federally, that possibly there's a federal grant. And I watched a previous committee. It looked like it was the cost was about $2.8 million. You can correct me if that's not right. So up until this point, has 988 been fully funded by federal grants?
Through the chair, Caroline has been funded through a contract with the Division of Behavioral Health through braided funding. And we haven't always been privy to all the details of how the division has pulled together that funding, but I can speak to a piece of that funding has been a federal SAMHSA grant, and that we have 1 year left in that grant. And that's $1 million annual grant.
I follow up. Yeah, I just wanted to confirm. So is the cost of the centers about $2.8 million total?
Through the chair, yes, at this time, that's our operating costs.
Okay.
Thank you. And I do want to go on to the next invited testifier, who is Chief Sean Case with the Anchorage Police Department. Thank you, Chief Case, for being here today.
Absolutely. Co-chair, as a member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony today. My name is Sean Case. I'm the Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department. I'm here to express my strong support for House Bill 138, establishing a behavioral health crisis service surcharge and fund. This bill represents a crucial step forward in addressing the growing need for accessible and effective mental health and substance use crisis intervention services across Alaska. I don't like to use the word crisis very often, but when I do, it's usually well needed, and we do face a crisis right now. The Anchorage Police Department, like other law enforcement agencies across the state, is increasingly called upon to respond to individuals experiencing behavioral health crises. These situations often require significant resources, divert officers from addressing other critical public safety needs, and can lead to outcomes that are not in the best interest of the individual in crisis or the community. Our officers are trained to de-escalate these situations, but they are not mental health professionals. We need a comprehensive system of care that provides appropriate support and treatment for individuals in crisis, diverting them from the criminal justice system whenever possible. The proposed legislation provides some solutions. This bill offers a sustainable funding mechanism to expand and enhance behavioral health crisis services. Specifically, it can assist with mobile response teams, bringing mental health professionals to the scene of a crisis to provide immediate assessment and support. We have two such teams in Anchorage right now with the Anchorage Police Department and the Anchorage Fire Department. Can also assist with crisis stabilization centers, offering short-term safe environments for individuals to de-escalate and receive initial treatment. This is a game changer in Alaska. The level of acceptable crisis is far too low in our communities. Crisis stabilization allows us to address challenges before they become full-blown crises. We'll also help enhance 24/7 crisis lines, as we just heard, providing immediate access to trained counselors who can offer support, resources, and referrals. provides training and education, equipping law enforcement officers, first responders, and community members with the skills to recognize and respond to behavioral health crises effectively, particularly given the diverse needs throughout Alaskan communities. Really, there are two huge benefits. The first thing is going to increase law enforcement time. By diverting individuals in crisis to appropriate care, this bill will free up law enforcement resources to focus on crime prevention and other critical public safety priorities. And second, and probably most importantly, it's going to improve outcomes for individuals. Providing timely and effective mental health services will lead to better outcomes for individuals in crisis, reducing the likelihood of hospitalization, incarceration, and other negative consequences. In closing, I urge the members to support this vital legislation, establishing a behavioral health crisis services surcharge and fund is a responsible and necessary investment in the health and safety of our communities. It will provide law enforcement with the tools and resources needed to better serve Alaskans experiencing behavioral health crises, leading to improved outcomes for individuals, families, and our entire state. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chief Case. Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Chief Gates, what is the current funding source for the Mobile Crisis Team and Crisis Stabilization Services that APD currently provides?
Currently, the municipality has, we fund it all ourselves with the exception of one of our clinicians, and we're finishing up a grant that will end in August that paid for a little over 2 years of one of our clinicians. And if I may address the previous question, through the chair?
Of course.
In other jurisdictions outside of Alaska that we visited and looked at some of their crisis response, generally what we see is that the funding that starts some of these programs, mobile responses, crisis stabilization, these types of things, usually comes from private sources or nonprofits or various different funding sources outside of the government. And once that system gets established and set up and it's determined that it's effective, then it generally gets woven into the operating budgets within these communities. And so King County is one example, Maricopa County and Arizona is also another example.
Okay. Thank you again, Chief Case, for being here and for the work that you and the officers do every day.
Absolutely. Thank you.
At this time, Representative Mina, would you like to summarize the bill to the extent that committee members don't understand it already?
For the record, Genevieve Mina, I'm the House District 19 representative for the Anchorage neighborhoods of Airport Heights, Mountain View, and Russian Jack. Thank you kindly to the House Labor and Commerce Committee and to the co-chairs for hearing House Bill 138, which is to fund behavioral health crisis services by enacting a surcharge on 988. As you heard from our invited testifiers, there is a dire need for funding behavioral health services because it's not just about addressing people who are in crisis, but it's also about making sure that we're having enough resources for public safety and addressing all of the issues in our state. People already know our high rates of suicide in the state, as well as having the highest rate for adolescents. And just to provide a little bit of background so people have a better understanding of behavioral health services and how we funded them, the state began redesigning our healthcare system in 2016 with the passage of Senate Bill 74, and that started a movement to also help improve behavioral health services. In 2019, Alaska moved forward with the 1115 Behavioral Health Waiver Demonstration, that's specifically in Medicaid, and that shifted Medicaid to be more data-driven and integrate our behavioral health system for Alaskans with serious mental illness, severe emotional disturbance, and/or substance use disorder. On October 17, 2020, the National Suicide Hotline Designation Act was signed into law by President Trump, which incorporated 988 into statute as the new Lifeline and Veterans Crisis Line phone number. It was formerly known as the Suicide Hotline. And in 2022, the Alaska Mental Health Trust partnered with the state of Alaska after the passage of House Bill 172 to implement Crisis Now, which is our new crisis framework to support Alaskans experiencing a behavioral health crisis. To ensure that they are receiving the right services at the right time, at the right setting. This Crisis Now 988 framework depends on the majority of these crisis cases being diverted to a call center, so 988. Then a smaller percentage of these cases would be handled in person with the work of mobile crisis teams, perhaps going to a crisis stabilization center for a few days or for a few days. And then the tiniest amount of these cases would go to a crisis residential center. And the whole framework of Crisis Now is that we want to shift away from people being pushed into institutionalized care, which we know costs more, whether it's API or DOC or not having the services altogether. Although we've modernized our behavioral health system, funding these services are a problem. We know that our behavioral health grants have been flat and that Medicaid rates for behavioral health are still in the process of being reformed and looked at within the division. Additionally, there is risk at the federal level of grants that fund services such as 988 from going away. And some of these concerns were vocalized by our invited testimony, Ms. Susanna Marchick with Caroline. What House Bill 138 does is create a new fund called the Behavioral Health Crisis Services Fund that would be administered through the Division of Behavioral Health. This fund is different from other behavioral health grants because it's specific to crisis services, and it would fund services such as the crisis call center, crisis stabilization centers. I know there are people have seen the news with the closure of the crisis recovery center, which is a subacute short-term adolescent stabilization facility, so it would help services such as those. And it would also help promote workforce stabilization because one of the biggest needs for behavioral health funding is the fact that we cannot fund the people who are on the front lines because they're not being paid enough. The way that the fund would be funded is through creating a surcharge of 98 cents per month on each wireless and wireline number with a billing address in the state. This would be 98 cents per month. We already have a surcharge on everyone's phone lines for 911. And so House Bill 138 replicates the surcharge that we have for 911 for 988 services at 98 cents a line. Additionally, the 911 surcharge is currently at $2 a month. So this is half that amount. We anticipate that House Bill 138 would raise at least $6 to $8 million because currently the 911 surcharge raises about $12 to $16 million for the state. And the benefits of this bill is that it would create stable, predictable funding for crisis services, including the crisis call center. It would save costs by alleviating the burden on law enforcement, first responders, hospitals, and corrections, and it would support services across the state. This is not a bill just about funding services in Anchorage. We want to make sure that all communities have the ability to have these types of services within the Crisis Now framework because not all communities have the ability to have these funding mechanisms. In closing, that is my presentation for House Bill 138. I'm happy to answer any questions. And, you know, we also have two people available for questions with the Division of Behavioral Health and the Tax Division within the Department of Revenue.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, one question about 988. Is 988 statewide? Can anybody in the state access it, or there might be some hot spots like 911 has, but is it generally a statewide service?
Through the co-chair to Representative Cologne, yes.
Okay. And then a follow-up? Mm-hmm. Well, a different question. So on page 1, line 8, so you were saying that this 98-cent charge is going to be on every wireless phone, but it says and for each local exchange access line for wireline phones. That sounds like a landline. Is it the landline charge this as well?
Through the co-chair to Representative Cologne, yes.
Okay, so it's cell phones and landlines. And also on the on some of this language around what companies have to do, my understanding is the telephone companies, if someone chooses not to pay that surcharge, they don't have to go after that debt. I'm trying to figure out if someone doesn't pay their telephone bill, what does a telephone company have to do when that's included?
Katie Giorgio, for the record, through the chair to Representative Cologne. The way our bill is written currently, there's no enforcement mechanism for the telecoms to necessarily collect and remit that fee to us. But you know, so theoretically, I suppose someone could just not pay that fee. But there's no enforcement action in the bill. We're not going to require the telecoms to go after them. It's something that we haven't really worried about because I don't think that's going to be a widespread problem. But again, we're trying to be friendly with the telecoms and not make this overburdensome.
Well, I would say that unpaid telephone bills is a widespread problem. I'm just trying to figure out, are they collecting on just their are they collecting all the surcharges? Because right now we pay for at least 4 surcharges already. So I don't know if adding another dollar is if they had to chase all that money too on top of the service. So thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. For the chair, my understanding is we don't use the surcharge on 911 calls. You gave me the numbers, $2 a month, $15 million a year, to pay for police training or police cruisers or firefighter training or recruitment or retention or fire engines. And the chief case can certainly correct me if I'm wrong there. But this bill envisions using the 988 crisis hotline to pay for a large range, in addition to the cost of the service, which is appropriate, would also pay for behavioral health services, recruitment, retention, training, direct behavioral services for a person experiencing a behavioral health crisis. I'll stipulate the mental health system has needs. I will stipulate that there are very dire social conditions in Alaska. Putting that aside, can you explain to me why you believe that using a surcharge on a telephone line is an appropriate way to provide funding such broad expense and expanse?
Well, let me give one example to start, Representative Sadler, and then maybe ask Representative Mina to just summarize some of the discussion in the Health Committee, because one thing we talked about in the Health Committee is, you make a call to 988 and you get referred to, you say if you're experiencing suicidal ideations, you talk to the person on the phone, but then you get referred to someone, a counselor who right now, because of the weakness of our system, may not actually be available. So the part of the idea is having care be available when needed, and maybe Representative Mina could share more on that, but also other discussion in department or in the HES committee. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I would appreciate the sponsor addressing the question, please.
Mm-hmm. Through co-chair Felis to Representative Sadler, thank you for the question. Part of the justification for having a surcharge that's not just specific to funding the services for 988 and funding behavioral health crises in general is because 988 doesn't function or it's not its most successful in a vacuum. 988 and the Crisis Care Line is part of a broader system with the Crisis Now framework. And for all of these elements to work as successfully as possible, 988 is the front lines of making sure that we're diverting most of these calls. But if there is a situation where you need to have a mobile crisis team come to the person or somebody needs to be stabilized, all of these pieces work in tandem. That's part of the justification for why this is not just for the care line. And that has been the modernization of our behavioral health system in this state.
To follow up? Mm-hmm. And to that point, I understand the everything is related to everything else argument. What are the limits? What could the revenue collected by this surcharge not cover?
Through the co-chair to Representative Sadler. So I believe that specifically in this bill on page 3, starting on lines 8 going down, those subsections delineate the parameters of what services this fund could go to. Right. But the discretion of whether the, let's say if a city was applying for one of these grants, that would be under the discretion of the Division of Behavioral Health, which we already grant the authority to for the behavioral health grants, okay, for recovery and treatment grants. Katie.
Katie Giorgio for the record, staff to Representative Mina through the co-chair to Representative Sadler. Thank you for the question. Just to back up briefly your earlier question about how other states do this. So I have a chart here I'd be happy to share with the committee about how some of the other states have structured how who have implemented a 988 telecom fee and how they've used those funds. And states have done a lot of different a lot of different frameworks, and we modeled ourselves most closely to the state of Delaware. And so I'll share this chart, but some states have it's just for the call center. They have other ways that they're funding behavioral health crisis services. Delaware, they decided to do a fund, so it sort of encompasses all of the possible uses for the crisis continuum of care. And one of our goals and the way that we drafted this bill and modeling after Delaware is to have a lot of flexibility. We're a diverse state. Obviously, there's a lot of unique needs of different communities. And really, truly, I mean, I see this really as a boon for rural communities who don't necessarily have what they need right now. And whether that's a small village and they need training for their behavioral health aide there, or, you know, or they need to stand up a facility like within their community, like a small, like one or two bed facility. I don't know. But the flexibility is there so that a community like Bethel can determine what they need in Bethel versus Eagle or Juneau or anywhere else. And that's, you know, and rural, of course, like we talk a lot about our suicide rates and how high they are, especially we're number one in youth suicides. And that primarily is coming from our rural sectors of the state. And so my goal would be to see those numbers go down if we are able to deploy more crisis resources to all corners of the state.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to the next question, do you want me to call on Andrea Mweka with Division of Behavioral Health to elaborate more on fundable services under the surcharge? Yeah, okay.
Sure.
Ms. Mweka, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Could you help answer Representative Sadler's question on what services can be funded by the surcharge? Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Andrea Mweka, our Deputy Director with the Division of Behavioral Health. And through the chair, this bill could be utilized for so many different things, such as our suicide prevention and training support, our crisis response and intervention services, as well as some of our other initiatives that we have with our crisis continuum services. We can also utilize these funds to improve regional support, access and provider supports, so that there's ways to build out capacity and service access throughout rural areas that are experiencing gaps in services and utilizing the funds in that way.
Okay.
So to follow up.
Let's, Representative Sadler, let's go to Representative Coulomb and then circle back to you, okay? Representative Coulomb.
Yeah, so with that, I want to point out, make sure I'm understanding this right. So page 3 on line 14, it says the legislature may appropriate to the Department of Health these things. On the end, it says this is not a dedicated fund. So there's no mandate that the money collected goes to behavioral health services. So we know how the legislature is, you know. So mm-hmm. I just want to make sure there's no guarantee that this fund is actually going to go to these services. My other concern is, and hopefully they would, but my other concern, which I had shared with the sponsor yesterday, is that you're taxing every single cell phone in the state, 98 cents statewide. You get a fund, and certain communities may apply for a grant from that fund. And so maybe a lot of that money just goes to Bethel. Maybe it just goes to Anchorage. Maybe it goes to Fairbanks. I'm not sure I'm comfortable taxing people in Nome a dollar on their cell phone to fund more mobile crisis teams in Anchorage. There's no way this pot of money is going to be able to say, yeah, it's going to be, all the communities are going to be covered. That it won't be. It will have to go to certain communities. And is that needed? Obviously, it's needed. But I think you could, like, why I asked why it was statewide is because remember, every single cell phone and landline in the state is going to be taxed 98 cents. And not everybody's going to benefit from that. They could benefit from 988. They could, and they do benefit from 911. And I understand that surcharge is going to operate 911. But this is different. This is creating a fund for other things, a little bit to what Rep. Sadler was saying. Now we're taking everybody's tax on their cell phone and probably appropriating to certain communities, not all communities. So that's just a concern I have, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the bill, but that's how I see it.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say, I guess for the record, that I'm concerned about, again, on page 3 from 15 on to 30, I guess, I'm concerned about the broad range of services that this fund would be envisioned to fund, to support specialized training to at-risk communities, providing behavioral health services, whether linguistically competent or not, providing behavioral education, providing services to a person experiencing a behavioral health crisis. I don't see a limit to that, unless it's just people with a crisis. And if crisis is the qualifier, that raises another question, that this is I'm hearing evidence and assertions that this is a mental health crisis. Would there ever be an end to the crisis which would obviate the need to collect these funds and provide these services? My presumption is that there is certainly a range of mental health services that the DOH provides, but this is presumed to be based, is based on a crisis. Would that crisis end, and if so, would the surcharge end? And maybe these are more philosophical questions we could develop elsewhere, but I just want to get those out to begin considering as we consider this bill. Thank you.
Representative Mina might like to address those philosophical questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Field. Through the co-chair to Representative Sadler, it's an interesting question about when is this justified and when is this not justified. I think for as long as we're still experiencing the highest rates of youth suicide in the nation and the second highest adult suicide rates in the state, there is a crisis.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just opining on my own kind of thoughts on this and where the discussion has gone. Philosophically, until we start investing in early education and other early childhood resources, we are not going to see this crisis go away. So until we start investing in those areas that will have an impact with positive downstream impacts, then I see this the surcharge being needed for quite a long time. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Let's go to Katie Giorgio and then Representative Carrick.
Just real quick, Katie Giorgio, for the record. In the way that I see this, the term crisis in the context of this bill, yes, we do have a statewide crisis. We have a nationwide crisis. But I see this as more of a crisis on an individual level. Someone who is in crisis, that's who's calling 988, or someone who knows someone who's in crisis. And this is about de-escalating that individual's crisis, whether they're contemplating suicide, whether they're overusing illicit drugs, whatever it might be. It's the individual person's crisis is the way I see that word in this bill and what we're trying to do. And just going back to the crisis recovery center closure, there was a lot of traffic on Facebook and other social media discussing that. And I can't tell you how many parents I saw comment on those Facebook posts about how the CRC saved my child's life. My child wouldn't be here without the CRC. So we're talking about people and children in crisis, and that's what we're trying to address here. The philosophical, when's this crisis going to be over? Who knows? Maybe never. But the kid who's in crisis today, I want to get them out of that crisis today.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. And I just want to thank Representative Mina for bringing this bill forward. I think it is actually structured in a way that's really good in that it's providing this surcharge, but is ultimately helping address a super critical need. I do, though, align myself a little bit with the comments of Representative Colom regarding regional distribution of the funds. And I was just curious, have there been any discussion about having some way to distribute funds per capita based on population in the state or based on need or any sort of way to ensure some sort of equitable distribution of funds, equal or equitable distribution of funds? Like, has that been something that's been considered?
Through Co-Chair Fields to Representative Carrick, it's a good discussion in terms of ensuring that the communities that are in need of services are able to have support for services, and also trying to ensure that the institutions that provide statewide services are also being supported. So there's a little bit of a tension there. Part of this bill was that we didn't want it to be too prescriptive in statute when we're giving the Division of Behavioral Health that ability to
work on the parameters for those funds. So I would defer to the Division of Behavioral Health, who's available for questions on how they address those questions with the current behavioral health recovery and treatment grants and how that could be applied to the behavioral health crisis grants.
Yeah, so behavioral health treatment grants have been, I think, very fairly distributed statewide in the time they've been issued. I mean, I think the state has tried to transition to a more sustainable model that's not so grant-dependent, but maybe Ms. Mueka could add to that.
Hi, Susan Co-Chair. This is Andrea Mueka, Deputy Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. We can certainly look at distribution. We do have call center data that does show where the most calls do come from, and we could potentially utilize that as a way to distribute into those communities. We also do have various grants that are required to be distributed in rural versus urban areas, and we could utilize standards and methodologies such as that.
A follow-up? Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate the answer. I used to work in tobacco prevention, and I'm not sure how our state funds for tobacco prevention services across the state were distributed, how those funding allocations were decided, other than where the grants were and where the need was. But when we're talking about a surcharge, I am curious about how we as policymakers can ensure that there is an either equitable or equal, it depends on how you want to look at the problem, distribution of funds. So I guess that's just a comment. And if you have any thought on is there a way to compare this to other state funds for preventative health services?
Through the co-chair, Representative Herrick, I believe the question was directed to me, and yes, we can definitely take a look at what other states are doing to allocate any funds such as this, and we can look at the tobacco taxes to see how that plays out as well. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just something to worth maybe comparing to. There's a few similarities between those two types of funds.
Representative Sadler is up next.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I guess a statement through the chair to the sponsor. You know, if as we've heard, the crisis may never be over, then we might as well just call this a behavioral health tax that's imposed on telephones. And it's going to provide a wide range of services, include, you know, providing services to a person experiencing behavioral health crisis. I just don't see an end to this, and I don't see the nexus between the phone line and the service provided there and the crisis response and the long-term structural support of the behavioral health system. I'm sure the Department of Health and the Division of Behavioral Health could use funding. It might seem more appropriate to just fund the services they want to provide through the regular appropriations process. It just seems like a kind of Rube Goldberg way to provide funding for essential services under the rubric of a crisis, but that's my opinion.
Okay. Representative Colomb did already draft an amendment. Thank you, Representative Colomb. Did other members have additional amendments they were contemplating, or do people feel like they have the information they need to make a decision on this bill? Because we could just take up the amendment now, basically.
Can we do an at ease, Chair?
Sure, brief at ease. On the record, thank you. So the amendment deadline for this bill is 2 p.m. Thursday, May 8th. Representative Colomas ahead of the game. Next up is, thank you, Representative Mina, for that discussion. Next up is House Bill 156 by Representative Mina. Representative Mina, thank you for being here. This is the second hearing. Do you want to do a bill recap of this?
For the record, Genevieve Mina, House District 19 Representative. Thank you to the committee for hearing House Bill 156 again.
House Bill 156 is about the labor market and workforce issues, and currently we are facing a shortage of labor in this state. We want to make sure that the job process for our labor market is efficient. If people are trying to hire folks as fast as possible and make sure that they're hiring the right person for their workplace, but also making sure that we're retaining workers and we're not billing jobs, but really advertising careers to individuals who we want to keep in our state. This bill helps improve our economy and our labor market by first requiring wage and salary disclosures and job postings, and also prohibiting employers from asking about salary history. And secondarily, it helps codify the existing National Labor Relations Act of the ability for employees to freely discuss wages in the workplace. The benefits of this bill is to help out the employer and the employee by not wasting time when it turns out you're going through the interview process and then the salary that you're looking for is lower than was what's needed for your family and for your needs. And additionally, it also helps address wage gaps that occur when people don't know how other folks are being paid for the same job.
Okay. Thank you. So we have invited in public testimony. First up in invited testimony is Jarrett Carson with Cornerstone General Contractors. Thank you, Mr. Carson, for being here. And please proceed.
First of all, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak for you today. I wanted to strongly, I identify that my support for HB 56 is from an HR practitioner standpoint. HB 156, which represents a critical step forward in creating a more transparent, equitable, and competitive job market across Alaska, this legislation moves forward and empowers job seekers, especially those navigating career transitions, returning to the workforce, or entering new industries, by requiring employers to disclose the wage range for a position early in the hiring process and providing employee protections related to wage transparency. With more than 25 years of industry experience, not just as an HR practitioner, but also as a college professor, I believe that this bill is going to help organizations, employees, applicants, and families. I recently went through a job transition where my company had to downsize and I was let go. Not seeing job salaries did create heartache and stress and frustration in my own job searches. So I fully support this from an HR perspective, but also an employee perspective. For small and growing companies, wage transparency levels the playing field. By clearly stating compensation expectations up front, we can attract qualified candidates who are aligned with our budgets and our competitive offerings rather than lose talent to confusion or larger organizations that can afford costly negotiations. HB 156 helps employers across the state, especially those in rural and underserved regions, compete on a foundation of clarity, not guesswork. As a recruiter and HR professional, I've seen firsthand how difficult interviews can be for applicants, especially when it comes to discussing salary. Job interviews are already a high-pressure experience, and a lack of structure around how to talk about compensation only adds to that stress. HB 156 provides clarity and consistency, giving both applicants and employers a fair and balanced framework to conduct transparent conversations. Structured expectations make the interview process smoother and more respectful, creating a better experience for everyone involved. HB 156 also protects applicants from being anchored to prior wages, which may reflect historical inequities or unrelated industries. Eliminating questions about current and previous pay ensures candidates are evaluated on skills, experience, and job alignment, not outdated compensation histories. This is a critical step toward fair hiring and addressing wage disparities, particularly for underrepresented and marginalized groups. Importantly, the bill also affirms a core workplace right, the freedom of employees to discuss wages without the fear of retaliation. Open conversations about compensation promote accountability and equity and ensures that workers have the information needed to advocate for themselves. However, I do have some clarifying amendments that I think would help strengthen and improve the implementation of the bill. One, clarifying the scope of wage discussion protections. As written, the bill provides broad protections to employees about discussing compensation. This could be unintentionally applied to individuals in confidential or fiduciary roles, such as HR professionals, supervisors, and or accounting staff, who have the access to salary data that is not their own. Protection should be limited to discussions of an individual's own compensation or general equity concerns, not the unauthorized disclosure of confidential personal information, or using my access to then compete for a higher salary for myself. Those should not be protected. Establish standardization and definitions for company size to avoid disproportionate impacts on smaller employers. HB 166 and other related legislation, such as HB 161, should include or reference clear definitions of company size. A recommended framework could include small employers are 1 to 49, medium 50 to 74, large 75 and above. These thresholds would ensure that consistent application to policies across bills and help protect Alaskan small businesses from unintended financial burdens that may be that may not be able to absorb while still advancing the goals of fairness and transparency. With this bill specifically, I think it should apply to all employers without regard to size. In summary, HB 156 fosters fairness, support for small business competitiveness, and improves candidate experience, builds public trust and hiring practices, and strengthens workers' protections. With thoughtful amendments to preserve confidentiality and scale expectations based on company size, this bill will lead to more transparent and equitable employment practices for all Alaskans.
Questions for Mr. Carson, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Carson, I heard several times in your testimony the terms fair wage or fairness and equity. Could you please help me understand what you mean by those terms, define them when it comes to workplace pay? What is a fair wage?
Yeah, so one of the things that I see when I'm generating workplace salary scales is I may offer somebody I have a bandwidth of salaries in my organization for a project manager, but if I'm offering this and another company isn't, what's happening is they may have offered a smaller salary for somebody else, or they may have left the company because it was a lower salary. When they come to my company, if I don't have a published salary scale, what will happen is I ask them, hey, what did you make at your last company? If it's lower than what I'm currently offering, I could give them that lower amount, and they feel like they got a great deal. But what I'm not doing is I'm not making them competitive against their peers within the group. So for my company, what we did was I actually printed out and published for my executive team everybody's salaries in their salary scales, where they were at considered to the median range, so that we could see that 80% of our PMs are above the median rate for their job skills, for their qualifications, and within a peer group. So now I can then say if somebody falls outside of that median group, I can look at that one person individually and say, why is there an outlier? One of our guys, I found that he was still working on his degree, and he was the least experienced. So instead of looking at it and seeing it as a totality of the group, I can actually identify why somebody's in the lower group, and then we can have conversations about how do they get into that median group, how do they bring theirs up, go back to school, get some qualifications, and grab some more experience. So that's what it does by creating greater transparency and creating, pay equity across the group. A lot of times you'll see somebody coming in with a resume that's one page versus somebody with four pages. Just because they have a one-page resume doesn't mean that they're not as qualified as somebody with a four-page resume. So by doing this, you're at least allowing them to start the conversation so that they understand where that minimum range is, and that gives them their starting point to have that conversation during the interview and not allow somebody who's not in the room to dictate a salary based on just a resume length.
And just briefly, because I know we have a lot to do today, it just seems that this presumes standardization of skills and values to a business, which are decisions I guess I would prefer to let the marketplace determine. I think you're substituting statistics and normalization to a direct benefit that an employee might bring to an employer. I'm philosophically not comfortable with this approach. So I won't raise that question or make those comments to everyone, but just for the record, I just don't like this approach.
Okay. Next up in invited testimony is, thank you, Mr. Carson. Next up in invited testimony is Dr. Mike Walsh with Forker Group. Go ahead, Mr. Walsh.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and Co-Chair Hall and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Michael Walsh. I'm Vice President of Public Policy for the 4-Acre Group, which serves as the state's nonprofit association and capacity builder for Alaska nonprofits. As the committed voice for Alaska's nonprofit sector, 4-Acre appreciates the opportunity to speak before the House Labor and Commerce Committee today in support of Representative Mina's House Bill 156, Disclosure of Wage Information. The 4-Acre Group was pleased to have testified recently in support of its companion bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senate Bill 78, sponsored by Senator Dunbar. Our interest in this bill relates to the data that might emerge, which helps us in our work related to gender pay equity, a topic we are genuinely dedicated to in our daily work and for the long haul. For context, part of our commitment to Alaska's nonprofit sector is to be a source of research that can be translated into policy action focused on improving the lives of Alaskans and the communities where we live. For more than two decades, 4-Acre has been gathering data and sharing information about the economic impact of nonprofits on Alaska's economy. We have gathered data on Alaska's nonprofit employment generally and Alaska's gender pay gap in particular. While we recently released the most up-to-date information on nonprofit employment generally, we're also on the verge of publicly releasing our latest data on the persistent existence of a gender pay gap in Alaska. We understand that House Bill 56, like Senate Bill 78, is focused on pay transparency as it relates to the larger issue of workforce development and not ending the gender pay gap. That said, we know from our extensive research that one goes hand in hand with the other. In other words, pay transparency is a critical tool in addressing gender pay equity. In my time today, I simply want to reiterate that the 4-Acre Group supports both House Bill 156 and its companion bill, Senate Bill 78, which will help with recruiting and retaining Alaska's workers across all sectors of the economy, including the 34,000 jobs currently in the state's nonprofit workforce. 4-Acre has been committed to advancing pay transparency for more than a decade. We proudly model this commitment on our free job board, which is heavily utilized across the state as a trusted source of information on nonprofit employment opportunities. As part of that commitment, 4-Acre requires each organization that posts on the job board to list the pay range, and we explain why that's important. Beyond our own internal efforts, we know there's considerable documented research showing that pay transparency laws support all workers in their job searches. We know that filling vacant positions is time-consuming and expensive, and maximizing both the employee's time and the job seeker's time is in everyone's best interest. Alaska will not be the first state to incorporate pay transparency, and we certainly don't want to be the last to adopt this common-sense solution for our workforce. Just another thank you, Representative Mina, for introducing House Bill 156. We look forward to sharing more ways we can all promote a healthy and vibrant Alaska workforce. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Walsh. So we did set an amendment deadline and received four amendments. However, Mr. Carson with Cornerstone suggested a couple of other ideas that it sounds like the bill sponsor is interested in reviewing. So I think we will take this bill back up at the next hearing. If you have additional amendment ideas prompted by today's testimony, go ahead and get them drafted. Please let us know you're working on them, and we will take up amendments and action on the bill at the next hearing. In addition to that, I'm going to open up public testimony on this bill. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer testimony? Seeing none, I don't see anyone online, so I'm going to close public testimony. And do any committee members have questions for Representative Mina before we move on to the next bill?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. I don't have a question for Representative Mina. I'm just curious, when are you setting extending the amendment deadline? When is that?
Yes, the amendment deadline will be extended to, I don't know, 10 a.m. on Friday. But just let it, if you have another amendment, just let us know.
That's your head.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a question. I don't know if this is Department of Labor. I had a question on the fiscal note.
Sure. Let's go to Jeremy Applegate, who's here with Department of Labor. Go ahead with your question, okay. Representative Klum.
Yes.
Jeremy Applegate's online.
Oh, okay. Great. So it looks like it's going to be $350,000 to implement this. legislation, and I guess I would like you to just kind of explain why, it, you know, usually in a fiscal note you see like a setup, and the first year is kind of big, and then the subsequent years are smaller. But it looks like you are putting three full-time positions to – can you kind of walk through what they would be doing?
Yes. For the record, this is Jeremy Applegate, Chief of Wage and Hour Office, State of Alaska, Department of Labor and Wage and Hour Office. And through the chair, the reason we have those three positions is that this bill creates a new type of investigation in our office. It's going to require an investigator three – because the type of investigations that we are looking at here are going to require, unlike our other investigations that are document-based, they're going to require investigations that revolve around determining what the employer's state of mind is. What we're looking at is essentially retaliation claims. It also opens up our enforcement not just to employee-employer relationships, but the relationship between potential employees and employers. Additionally, this bill puts into place a fine structure due to violations. And if that were to pass into law, what we have then is the need for essentially a fair hearing process. And the fair hearing process ultimately will require us to enter into hearings, which creates a large amount of paperwork and activity. Plus, there's also the collection mechanism that goes into play when we have to collect on those fines. So I hope that satisfies your inquiry.
Okay. Further, Representative Sadler and Representative Nelson also have a question on this bill.
Yes, I guess I'd direct this to the sponsor, and we can parse that if we need to. Noticing in the fiscal note that it says that every employer, public and private, shall include a full description of the salary and or salary ranges. So my question, would a potential employer, be obligated to pay a wage to a new hire that fell within that salary range? And if so, what would prevent an employer from covering themselves by having an extraordinarily wide range of salary, like between $20,000 and $200,000? Who would adjudicate that? Who would say whether that was a fair range or not? And what would the enforcement be? And maybe what the fine would be for not doing it?
Through the co-chair, through to Representative Sandler, thank you for that question. I think that we are trying to strike a balance with this bill to not be too onerous on small business owners and having them be We're not the ones to decide what is the right wage or salary range for a specific job. What we want is transparency for the prospective employee and for the employer. And an employer could put a range between $20,000 and $100,000. I don't think it's up for us to decide whether that makes sense or if that's fair, but I do think that somebody who is looking for a job should at least know what that range is.
Okay. So just clarify. So there would be no obligation on the employer to pay a wage that fell within that range. Is that correct?
Through co-chair Fields to Representative Sadler, right now in the bill, it is expected, our intent is that the job posting would be tied to the actual job, but we could certainly take a look at the bill to see if that is a requirement or not.
It would be my desire that it not that there not be that requirement, because that's going a much farther step forward towards determining what wages are, and that should not be how a capitalist system operates. So, unless we want the state to set wages for jobs, maybe we'll work on that amendment.
Okay, Representative Garrick. Representative Nelson, then Garrick. I'm getting out of order here.
No worries. Through the chair, to the bill sponsor, no, I appreciate the intent of this piece of legislation. You know, it's always disheartening to be online and trying to find a job and, you know, doesn't post any sort of salary. But following on from Representative Sadler's point about having such a wide range of salary, it kind of removes the impotence of this bill if we're if we just allow a company to say $20,000 to $2 million and somewhere it's going to fall in that range, that doesn't give a clear answer to anyone applying for a job. That doesn't really equate to anything. And now it's going to cost a lot of money to have that, even though federal government's already kind of looking at some provisions of this bill. It's already protected. You know, can't talk about, or you can talk freely about how much you make. So I'm just a little confused as to why we're pushing so hard for this bill when there's not a lot of teeth into it to actually go what you're promising or what your intent is.
Through Co-Chair Fields to Representative Nelson, thank you for that question. Right now, this bill is a bill about wage and salary transparency, and I think it's better to have information about a job rather than not have any information. If you think the information is too broad, or you might be in a position where you could, you might not have a wage in that job that is what you want because there's such a broad range, that's up to the person to decide. But more information about a job posting and a pace of employment is better than not having that information at all. Secondarily, in terms of not having teeth, there is enforcement related to civil fines and penalties that is in the bill, and I believe that there are amendments to try to ameliorate that enforcement as well. So there are enforcement provisions in the bill.
Follow-up. And I appreciate that. What I'm just trying to get at is someone can easily go around the punitive actions by posting such a wide range. And so, yes, there's some transparency, but at the same time, there's not. Because, sure, somewhere in that range of $20,000 to $2 million, the salary will fall in. But that doesn't tell me anything at the same time. So that's just where I'm getting at. It's a bit confusing as to the point of this legislation. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
So, Representative Nelson, the other jurisdictions around the world have done this, and they have substantially reduced their gender pay gap just through transparency. And that's why this policies like this exist. So it works, basically, without being onerous. That's why there are bills like this.
Well, and follow up real quick to you. Well, to the chair, and I understand that, but what other countries have done is given a bracket to say, hey, it has to be within a certain amount of what actually is paid for, not having it wide open where there's nothing really to hold that bar, either left or right limits. So, and that's why I appreciate the intent of this piece of legislation, but there's nothing really going after to ensure that the salary is what's going to be posted and what's going to be seen. So.
Hey, Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I note that the fiscal note says that Wage and Hour anticipates 3 full-time positions are needed to handle the influx of calls, questions, and complaints and fines and fulfill the statutory obligations of the legislation. We have a $304,000 plus personnel services, but I'm not seeing a fiscal note that describes the revenue from all the complaints and fines that are even listed in this fiscal note that we would anticipate. And I guess that's more of a comment. I would like to see a fiscal note that offers an estimation of how much we might collect in those fines and if that might potentially offset the costs of the legislation. Do you have a perspective on that or what has taken place in other states in terms of cost and how that's been accounted for?
Through Co-Chair Fields to Representative Carrick, I'm not quite sure of costs in terms of fines related to businesses. That's something that we can certainly look into with other states.
To follow up, it's more of a rhetorical comment. I find it interesting that the fiscal note estimates we need all these new positions for a large influx of calls, questions, and complaints and addressing fines, but we don't have anything suggesting what we would take in fines, assuming that that is the case. And so I would just like to see a fiscal note that says that as the bill moves forward in the process.
Okay. Well, I think Mr. Applegate is listening, so maybe you can take that under advisement and potentially come back. So the updated amendment deadline to address some of the issues brought up in public comments is 10 a.m. Friday. Next bill up in the agenda is House Bill 178 from Representative Mina. This is a bill on medical debt. It's the fourth hearing. We took public testimony. We received 4 amendments. So in addition to Representative Mina and her staff, Brad Lipton from the Consumer Federation of America, and I think Conrad Gunther are online if people have questions while we go through amendments.
Let's move in first, please. Sir.
So with that, should we go through the amendments? Are you ready to represent Clem?
Give me a second.
Okay, let's just take a brief at ease.
Yeah, let's do that.
Back on the record in Labor and Commerce. Go ahead, Representative Clum.
I move Amendment N1.
Object.
Okay, so this amendment, I had some concerns about some of my questions were about bigger debt that was long-lasting, and if they were trying to get a loan or trying to sign a lease. I think, you know, I'm concerned about the ones that are larger and have a financial impact on someone. So for this, it's a 12-month limit. So it keeps the medical debt of a person hidden. If the debt is 12 months or less outstanding, this amendment is concurrent with general creditor reporting practices, as they generally do not post medical debt that is age 12 months or less. So it's basically, it's still hidden up to a year, but after a year, it would be reported.
Okay. Any feedback on this amendment, Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. I oppose this amendment, but I do appreciate the amendment sponsor, Representative Colomb, for considering just how medical debt does impact credit reports. I know that right now the main credit reporting agencies, as represented by the consumer DIA, I don't remember what that stands for, they did make changes in response to increased scrutiny on the correlation between medical debts and someone's credit trustworthiness. So upon this, they have stopped reporting delinquent medical bills that are under 12 months old. The issue that I have with this, even though this codifies basically what the credit reporting industry is doing, my issue is that there are people that are still out there that are working back and forth with their insurance companies for bills that is taking longer than 12 months out of the year. And what I don't want to do is unnecessarily put people in a position where if you happen to have your bills resolved underneath those 12 months, then your bill won't be reported. But if you're still trying to go back and forth between an insurance company or with a hospital, then you are getting dinged on your credit report.
Okay. Are there further questions or discussion? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, I kind of like this amendment. In researching the issue, I've seen that the national credit reporting agencies did try and take an incremental nuanced approach to medical debt by exempting a certain amount. I think this takes a slightly different but still, I think, nuanced approach to say that a person who's had debt for less than 12 months, yeah, they might be able to pay it off quickly. And what we should be concerned about is the more ongoing, you know, the horror story case where someone's got $100,000 and it's the dogs for the rest of their life. So I think short-term, less than 12 months, I think that's a reasonable accommodation that protects the rights of the person to try and reestablish their financial footing, but also holds out the promise that a credit agency or someone wanting to lend the money for something will know of significant debt. So I think this strikes a good balance. So I'll support it.
Okay. Not seeing further discussion. Will the secretary call the roll?
Representative Burke.
No.
Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall.
No.
Co-Chair Fields.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
By a vote of 3-4, Amendment 1 does not pass. I'm going to move Amendment 2, also known as N.3.
Object for discussion.
Thank you. Part of the goal of House Bill 178 is to improve the ability of someone with crippling medical debt to be able to find housing and employment. Employers often run background checks, including credit scores in the application process. They don't explicitly ask about medical debt. This amendment simply removes medical debt as a protected class in employment in order to simplify the bill. I just want to turn to Representative Mina and double check that this amendment makes sense to the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. I do support this amendment. So originally, part of this bill was about discrimination from employers or prospective landlords related to medical debt, but landlords do ask about your medical debt often on rental applications, but employers don't ask about your medical debt explicitly. And it, as we looked at the other aspects that is currently considered as a protected class under non-discrimination issues, we just thought that medical debt seemed a little bit out of vogue with these other classes. And in order to clean up the bill and be more intentional about specifically targeting where we see medical debt impacting people who are trying to pay their medical debt, we wanted to just focus on landlords, rental applications, and credit reports.
Okay. Is there further discussion?
I remove my objection.
Is there further objection to Amendment 2? Not seeing objection, Amendment 2 or N.3 passes. Amendment 3 is from Representative Sadler.
Very good, Mr. Speaker. I'm sorry, I keep doing that, Mr. Speaker. I will move Amendment N.5.
I'll object.
All right. This simply removes Section 4 from the bill. That's the section that bars a medical collections agency from reporting medical debt to a credit agency, and if they do, the penalty is the debt's canceled, which is pretty cool. We've actually heard conflicting legal advice as to whether Section 4 violates federal laws that preempt states from passing their own laws regulating medical debt. In my mind, I think, and the record will show, that question remains unresolved. So by removing Section 4, we avoid that potential conflict and clear the way for the bill's clear passage for it otherwise.
Representative Mina, do you oppose or support this amendment?
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. I oppose this amendment. The credit reporting part is a main aspect of this bill. I believe in states' rights, and even though there is a private industry that is in litigation with the feds, if you look at the case law, there's a case, I believe, in Connecticut, and also a Ninth Circuit case that has ruled that there is not narrow preemption that would render the Credit Reporting Act from superseding the state's ability to regulate credit reports in a way where we could prohibit a medical debt from being reported on credit. And I also have Mr. Lipton online to be able to speak to that, or we talk to the legal drafter as well. But I just wanted to highlight that we've had many legal memos on this issue, and that is because this is a complex topic. And just because there is ongoing federal litigation, look at the case law. We have the ability to regulate these credit reports.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Lord grant me a one-armed attorney, or one-handed attorney, yep. So if on one hand, the other hand. So I appreciate that, but given the expeditious nature in which this is proceeding, I think it might make it better to be a claim bill going forward if we were to avoid that conflict and not engage in that debate continuously.
Do members want to hear again from Mr. Lipton? We have discussed this before. Okay. Is there further discussion? I'll maintain my objection. Will the Secretary call the roll on Amendment 3 or N.5?
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Cologne.
Yes.
Representative Burke.
No.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Co-Chair Hall.
No.
Co-Chair Fields.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
By a vote of 3-4, Amendment 3 or N.5 does not pass. Next up, I will move Amendment 4 or N.6. There's an objection. This amendment just is a suggestion alleged legal in fixing a technical error in drafting the bill, which had referenced the wrong statute. This amendment corrects the reference to the definition of medical debt with the definition on page 3, line 30 through page 4, line 2. Representative Mina, does this look like it's cleans up that issue? Do you support this amendment?
To Co-Chair Fields, yes, I do support this amendment. We were working with the legal drafter, and I want to thank Representative Sadler for bringing up an issue with the bill.
It was written with an error. So that fixes the error, and it appropriately references the definition of medical debt that is in the bill.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Is the objection maintained?
I remove my objection.
Seeing no further objection, Amendment 4 or N.6 passes. Are there further questions for the bill sponsor before we take action on this bill? Okay. Representative Hall.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report HB 178, Work Order 34-LS0569-N out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Object.
Okay. There is objection. Will the Secretary call the roll?
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Colomb.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Burke.
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall.
Yes.
Co-Chair Fields.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
Okay, so by a vote of 5-2, House Bill 178 does pass from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to transition to a bill by someone other than Representative Mina. Thank you, Representative Mina, for being here. All right, back on the record in Labor and Commerce, this is an introductory hearing on House Bill 110, Social Work Licensure Compact, by Representative Gray. Thank you, Representative Gray and Mr. Johansson, for being here to present your bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. For the record, my name is Andrew Gray. I represent House District 20, the UMed District, and Anchorage. House Bill 110 seeks to increase the number of social workers in Alaska by having Alaska join a multi-state social worker license compact. This effort aims to address the urgent and growing need for qualified social workers in Alaska as quickly as possible. Alaska is currently experiencing a critical shortage of social workers across various sectors, including mental health, education, and services for vulnerable populations. We face significant challenges in retaining qualified professionals with high turnover rates and increasing demand exacerbating the problem. In response, the University of Alaska has launched targeted training programs such as the School-Based Social Work Education and Network Development Initiative. This program prepares school-based social workers to meet urgent mental health needs in high-poverty areas. However, despite these efforts, the demand for social workers in Alaska continues to rise. In fact, the state projects a 13% increase in demand over the next 3 years. I'm going to speak just momentarily about my own personal experience working in two different organizations that had a 50-state compact. The first would be in the Army National Guard, where I had a medical license as a physician assistant when I joined the California National Guard. And then when I moved to Alaska, I was immediately able to practice in the National Guard here because you need a license, not the license of a particular state. More relevant to what we're talking about today, though, was my work with the Alaska VA. And I think that's important to talk about as also being a 50-state compact, because I think one of the things that is a misconception is that if you're part of a large multi-state compact, that would somehow drive down wages And the Alaska VA is the second highest paid VA in the country. And the reason why it's the second highest paid VA in the country is if you want people to move here from California or Florida or Georgia or New York, you're going to have to pay them more. That's just the simple truth. And so I think just to state that up front, that I actually believe that joining an interstate licensure compact would drive up wages in order to more easily attract people. I will also say, as somebody who has a professional license in two different states, California and Alaska, California, which is hardly seen as a non-bureaucratic state, had a much more straightforward and easy process in attaining a license than Alaska. And so I think lowering the red tape for folks in other states to arrive here and start working immediately, I think is something that we should pave the way for. Finally, I'll just note that we have had some big issues in public assistance by lack of workers. Public assistance programs have experienced processing delays, growing case backlogs. Addressing the shortage of social workers is essential to strengthening Alaska's health, education, and protective services in taking care of those backlogs and getting rid of our delays in processing applications. This legislation would definitely be a part of the solution for those problems, and I respectfully ask for the support of this committee and House and supporting House Bill 110. Thank you so much, committee, for hearing this bill today.
Great. Let's skip the section and go to invited testimony. First up is Tony Protzman. Ms. Protzman, please proceed.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the invitation. Through the chair, hi, everyone, and thank you again. I'm Tony Protzman. I'm the executive director of the Alaska chapter of the National Association of Social Workers and a lifelong Alaskan. I also chair the Alaska Mental Health Board, and I serve on the statewide suicide prevention council. But today I'm speaking to you as the executive director to discuss Alaska joining the social work compact. So thank you. NASW supports Representative Andrew Gray and Andy Story, House Bill 110. I'm not sure if you know that Andy Story is also a social worker. The Social Worker License Compact and the Association of NASW has 120,000 members worldwide. It's the largest professional organization of social workers. And in Alaska, there's about 1,200 social workers. When we surveyed our members, 90% of our members supported the compact. The compact is really here to strive to enhance access to social work services in Alaska, really in rural areas and underserved regions in Alaska, by really minimizing barriers to practice between state lines. And it's also, hopefully, it's going to improve social work mobility, telehealth services, and promote workforce flexibility. When we look at Alaska's workforce, it's projected to see a 13% increase in social work positions by 2028. And this is really driven by our aging population and the moderate overall growth in our state. So the doubling of senior citizens by 2030 will further increase the demand for social workers in our state. Despite the modest population growth, clinical services needs are rising, and we're really at a need for more practitioners in our state. Alaska really stands to gain from the social work licensure compact by simplifying the licensing procedures for our social workers, and hopefully an influx of qualified professionals and improving client services. Representative Gray talked a little bit about streamlining license. Alaska has 21,000 active military members and dependents, and they often face barriers to license reciprocity, oftentimes the spouses are, and it's leading an unemployment rate of up to 22%, which is five times higher than non-military adults in the U.S. So this is really set up to help our military population as well. So social workers overall play a critical role in various settings, including mental health services. And by Alaska joining the contract, we really facilitate the provisions of social work within our own state and really enabling access to services while maintaining public safety. So thank you for your opportunity to share and support for House Bill 110.
Thanks, Ms. Bison. Next up in invited testimony, Ms. Protzman, next up in invited testimony is Caitlin Bison with Council of State Governments. Ms. Bison, please proceed.
Members of the committee, I would like to express my appreciation for your consideration of the Social Work Compact. My name is Caitlin Bison with the Council of State Governments, and I just want to provide you with some background educational information on the compact. First, just to introduce the Council of State Governments, through its National Center for Interstate Compacts, has facilitated the development process for all 18 of the active occupational licensing compacts, including the two that Alaska is already a member of. The Social Work Compact seeks to provide licensees with opportunities for multi-state practice, support relocating practitioners, and foster workforce development by reducing licensure burdens. The compact was created through a cooperative agreement with the Department of Defense and the Council of State Governments. CSG developed or facilitated the development of the compact language with stakeholders from the profession, including ASWB, NASW, the Clinical Social Work Association, regulatory boards, and social workers. The compact will enable social workers to obtain a multi-state license issued by their home state to practice in other states that join the compact rather than get a license in each state they want to practice in. So like the compact for a driver's license, each compact member state agrees to mutually recognize the practitioner license issued by every other member state. The Social Work Compact is similar in form and function to the other two licensing compacts that Alaska is a member of, where a social worker must hold an active unencumbered license in their home state to be eligible for a multi-state license. They must also pass a background check and meet other eligibility requirements related to education and examinations. From a regulatory perspective, the compact preserves the authority of each member state to protect public health and safety through the existing state regulatory structure. A licensee practicing under a multi-state license must abide by the laws, regulations, and rules that govern the practice of social work in the state where they are located. The Alaska Board of Social Work Examiners would have jurisdiction over anyone practicing in Alaska under a multi-state license. And then, like all of these other licensure compacts, the Social Work Compact will be governed by a commission made up of member states. Currently, it is made up of 26 member states. So if enacted in Alaska, a representative from the Board of Social Work Examiners would serve as a delegate on the compact commission and have an equal voice in voting on the commission's rules. So overall, the compact will increase licensure portability for social work professionals in Alaska, support military families, improve access to social work services for Alaska residents, all while maintaining the current system of state licensure. Thank you.
Thank you. In addition to the bill sponsor, Sylvan Robb and Glenn Saviors from DCCED are online for questions. Are there questions, Representative Plum?
Can I ask a question to whoever was just speaking?
Oh, sure, of course. Yeah. Ms. Bison, you have a question.
Yeah, so I have a question on, and I've asked this on the other compact bills. So on page 23 of the bill, it says the commission may levy on and collect an annual assessment from each member state. So I don't see anywhere addressed that Alaska would have to pay right now. Is there a fee assessed, an annual fee that Alaska has to pay, or maybe there's not one right now?
Yes, so the Social Work Commission just began, being set up last May. They're still in the beginning stages, and multi-state licenses aren't yet being issued. So they have not discussed assessing the states, although that is an option. So that's not a conversation currently, but I will say out of the 18 licensure compacts, only two so far have ever assessed the states. The commissions are made up of representatives from state licensing boards, so there's kind of an inherent disincentive to do so.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Bison, good to see CSG doing good services for us. Is there any information on, some of the concerns I've heard is that if a state joins a compact, essentially a pipeline opens both ways. We anticipate the benefits of having additional people coming to Alaska to practice their professions, but it also creates a pathway for people to leave Alaska to practice their professions elsewhere. Given that CSG has the Center on Compacting, you might have data. Any information or data results as to what happens to the net number of professionals in a profession after they join a compact? Do they tend to lose more people, gain more people? Does it mix and match? What, any evidence you have in data would be helpful.
Yes. So we don't have any evidence for the social work compact specifically, since the multi-state licenses are not being issued, but there are a couple studies that I would be happy to send over to the committee.
Great. That'd be very helpful. Would you be able to opine just a little bit if there's a net, or is it subtle? Or inconclusive?
There is one for the IMLC, the medicine compact. I believe there is, I forgot exactly how they worded, but new practices or something like that, an increase in that. And then there is one for the nursing compact as well, I believe. And I can send those over, like I mentioned.
Representative Gray had a...
Thank you.
I
would like to address that question through the co-chair to Representative Sadler. If you love somebody, set them free. So the idea that we wouldn't do a compact because we want to keep everybody here is not what I would do. And I believe that the compact is part, basically allows for a more capitalist free market system. If we want to keep social workers in Alaska, then we must pay them more, and allowing them to freely move to any of the other 26 states would incentivize employers to increase their pay and benefits. So that's if we were seeing an out-migration, it would be because we're not paying them enough, and we would need to pay them more to keep them here.
Through the chair, there could be many reasons why people might come or leave, certainly, and I understand the establishment in increments of a common market for professionals, as it were. And certainly, my intent is not to keep people I love locked up in the basement, but just to know, but just his metaphor is not mine. It is almost 5 o'clock, people. But my desire is just to find out what the evidence might be as to what the transference, what the net result is. If Alaska is a great place to practice, you might see more.
Follow-up. Through the co-chair Fields to Representative Sadler. I just can't – if there's 26 states in the compact, they can't all lose population. They would have to be going to each other. So I would guess that 13 of the states would have gained and 13 of them would have lost, and the ones that lose would raise their wages and would attract back. Sure. And so, again, it would be a free market issue. Thank you.
Okay, great.
I do have questions of other witnesses if we are testifying.
Oh, go ahead.
Please, they'll be much more decorous.
Yep.
To Ms. Protzman with the National Association of Social Workers, I guess I'd just like to ask you to address a couple of the common concerns, kind of like what I just said. If 90% of those surveyed supported it, compacting, any information anecdotally or statistical as to why? Some of the arguments is compact will expose you, your profession, to more competition from people migrating into Alaska, and there's a risk also that people may leave Alaska. And, of course, the benefit, I'll stipulate, certainly there's benefit of having more people, but any information backing up that 90%, which is a pretty substantial endorsement, just any more detail as to why they support it so strongly?
Well, Representative Saylor, I think Ms. Protzman is no longer online, I don't know if Representative Gray wants to attempt to answer that question. And if not, I'm sure you can.
She did the survey, though.
Through the co-chair to Representative Sadler, we would need Ms. Protzman would be the subject matter expert on Alaskan social workers, and I apologize that she's no longer online.
Okay. That's okay. So the amendment deadline for House Bill 110 is Thursday, May 8th at 2 p.m. Representative Sadler has another question.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I have a question for the sponsor now, directly to you. I guess it gets kind of to your goal. Is your goal to, there's a telehealth component is you're going to allow Alaska social workers to treat people in the lower 48 via telehealth, or is it to draw more social workers to Alaska, or is it to allow more, I don't want to say state hopping, but more flexibility or a combination? Is there, can you prioritize your intents with this?
Through co-chair Fields to Representative Sadler, I think a combination of all three. I will say that I thought a lot about this when I was touring the DOC facilities during the interim and their lack of mental health care, and talking. So I was imagining that they might have a ability, especially with us adding the iPads, passing, if that gets passed across, of virtual social workers being able to service our DOC folks, possibly not being in Alaska. I think the overall goal, though, is that we'd like to, this 13% vacancy rate of social workers, I think we would love to actually have physical bodies here. But I'm open to all that the compact would allow, which would be for folks here to be moonlighting in other states, folks in other states to be working here virtually, and also to encourage folks to settle in our great state.
Well said. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. So the amendment deadline, 2 p.m. Thursday, May 8th on 110. So we will return to this bill shortly. Last on the agenda, Senate Bill 54 by Senator Klayman. First, I'm going to open this bill to public testimony. And I'm just going to inform people we are going to take action on this bill. So I see lots of public testimony. Please limit your testimony to 2 minutes, ideally 1 minute, so we can go ahead and pass this bill today. So I'm going to open public testimony. Nobody is in the room. Casey Key is online. Go ahead, Casey Key.
Good evening, Co-Chair Field and Hall, and members of the committee. My name is Casey Key, and I'm an Anchorage resident and CIDC certified interior designer. I'm here to express my personal support of Senate Bill 54 with the full inclusion of registration for interior designers. I strongly oppose the proposed amendment to strike interior design from the bill. Thank you for your continued consideration of this matter. Please pass Senate Bill 54 unamended.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Key. Next up, Larry Cash. Mr. Cash, do you want to proceed with your testimony?
Yes, good evening. I hope you can hear me. My name is Larry Cash, and good afternoon, members of the committee. As an Alaska architect and fellow of the American Institute of Architects, I have practiced architecture in Alaska for 45 years with qualified interior designers, and now I enthusiastically support this voluntary state registration with stamp and seal privileges as provided by SB 54. Please support this bill to extend the AELS board, make board recommendation updates, and create registration for Alaska's interior designers. Now is the time. Please pass SB 54 without amendments. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Cash. Next up in public testimony is Barbara Cash. Ms. Cash, please proceed.
Hello, and good afternoon, Co-Chairs Field and Hall and members of the committee. I'm Barbara Cash. As a long-term Alaska resident and nationally credentialed interior designer, I strongly support SB 54 as written without amendment. Please extend the board, update the statute, and register Alaska interior designers. Please pass SB 54. Thank you so much for your service.
Thanks, Ms. Cash. Next up is Melissa Tribble. Go ahead, Ms. Tribble.
Hello, co-chairs Field and Hall and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Tribble. I am an Anchorage Hillside resident and an NCIQ certified interior designer and a business partner here in Anchorage at MCG Explore Design. I'm here to express my support of an unamended SB 54 as it will allow expanded options to our community and keep more work here in the state of Alaska. Thank you so much for your continued consideration on this bill, and please pass SB 54 without amendment. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Tribble. Next up is Dana Nunn. Go ahead, Ms. Nunn.
Good afternoon, Chair Fields and Hall and members of the committee. My name is Dana Nunn. I'm a longtime Anchorage resident and NCIDQ certified interior designer. I'm here to express my personal support and also that as representative of the American Society of Interior Designers, Alaska Chapter, and the International Interior Design Association Northern Pacific Chapter, of which Alaska Interior Designers are members. To be clear, we did hear that there was an amendment which will be heard today which strikes interior designers from the bill, and we unequivocally oppose this amendment. But we do ask that you support SB 54 as it's written, which represents reasonable regulation, the culmination of many years of collaborative efforts. Please pass SB 54. Thank you so much for your continued consideration. And I'm also available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nunn. Next up is Ashley Killian. Go ahead, Ms. Killian.
Yes, hello. Good evening, Co-Chairs Fields and Hall and members of the committee. My name is Ashley Killian. I am an Anchorage resident and interior designer qualified to take the NCIDQ exam this fall. I'm speaking today in support of SB 54 personally, with the full inclusion of interior designers. I oppose the proposed amendment to strike registration of interior designers from the bill. Thank you for your time and your continued consideration. Please pass SB 54 unamended. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Killian. I do want to note Colin Maynard is available for questions. He's the chair of the Legislative Liaison Committee for the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. So when we close out public testimony, we can go back to Mr. Maynard if members wish. Next up in public testimony is Craig Bledsoe.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Craig Bledsoe, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm a 35-year resident of Eagle River. I am a licensed professional engineer and an aircraft accident investigator. I would like to express my strong support for SB 54 as originally filed and not as amended to strip out provisions for the establishment of the interior design registration. In general, I am in favor of eliminating burdensome regulations that restrict general commerce. However, in this case, I believe that Alaska's failure to recognize the interior design profession will directly lead to the loss of employment opportunities for resident interior designers and a loss of in-state revenue as money streams outside to appropriately licensed lower 48 contractors. The reason for this is that many federally funded contracts require that there must be a licensed interior designer accomplishing the design safety work on all applicable parts of the structure. If that certification does not exist in state, then all of the problems I've just described will come into play. In conclusion, I respectfully request that you support the passage of SB 54 as originally published. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thanks, Mr. Bledsoe. Next up, Melissa Wiltfong.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, Fields and Hall, and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Wiltfong. I am an Eagle River resident and a commercial interior designer working in downtown Anchorage. I am here to express my full support of SB 54 with the full inclusion of interior design registration. I oppose the proposed amendment to strike registration of the interior designers from this bill. Thank you for your continued consideration and support to pass SB 54 unamended.
Thank you, Ms. Wiltfong. Next up, Catherine Fritz. Go ahead, Ms. Fritz.
Thank you, Co-Chair Field. Ms. Catherine Fritz. I live in Juneau. I'm an architect of 35 years and have been a resident of Alaska for 42 years. I've been an active member of the Alaska chapter of the AIA that has currently a neutral position on SB 54 because of its premise as a title act. Just to be clear, AIA does not support SB 54. But today I'm testifying as an individual and asking that you consider amending SB 54 by removing Section 2 that adds two seats to the AALS board. I served on the board for 8 years, two as chair. The board is already our state's largest, and while it oversees more than 6,500 registered design professionals, there are many commonalities between the disciplines, especially the 15 branches of engineering, and not all are represented on the board. SB 54 increases the board size by providing separate seats for mechanical and electrical professions. This is unnecessary. In 2023, through SB 126, a restriction that did not previously allow mechanical and electrical engineers to reserve simultaneously was removed. This bill also allowed more work to be delegated to the AELS staff, which has reduced the board's workload. The bill also dedicates a new seat to registered interior design. There are currently only 23 Alaskan interior designers with the credential to be eligible for registration, so there'll be very few to draw from for board service. But my bigger concern is the inappropriateness of an interior designer to serve on the board since they will be regulated through a title act.
A seat on the board gives authority and responsibility for all of the regulated practices of engineering, architecture, etc. A seat for interior design is not appropriate since it will not be regulated as a practice itself. In 1998, when landscape architecture was added to the board, a temporary seat was made to provide expertise for regulation development. This could be a practical compromise to consider for SB 54. If the legislature really feels it's necessary to license interior designers, then I urge you to consider the least restrictive and most efficient provisions possible. Based on my 35 years as an architect, I cannot think of any need to increase the cost and operational complexities that will result from expanding the AELS board. Please amend SB 54. I've also learned that HB 215 has been introduced and referred to this committee. It, too, increases the size of the AELS board, but does not address interior design. I oppose the increase in board membership that is proposed in this bill as well. Thank you sincerely for your time today.
Thanks, Ms. Fritz. Next up, John P. Carr.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you, Co-Chairs Fields and Hall, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Picard. I'm a resident of Anchorage and a civil engineer. I'm testifying personally and as the president of the Alaska Professional Design Council, or APDC. APDC represents 1,000 design professionals who are registered by the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. We support Senate Bill 54 without the proposed amendment. We support extending the board, including the board recommended changes, and creating registration for interior designers. Please pass Senate Bill 54 unamended. Thank you for your consideration.
Thanks, Mr. Picar. Next up, Mary Knoth.
Yes, Co-Chairs Field and Hall and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Knoth, and I am an NCIDQ certified interior designer who resides in Anchorage. Interior designers play an important role as part of a commercial design team, impacting the health, safety, and welfare of the public. I am asking you to pass SB 54, adding registration of interior design under the purview of the current AELS board. This bill will allow qualified interior designers the autonomy to independently take responsibility for their own work. I understand there is an amendment to SB 54 to be introduced today that would remove registration of interior design from this bill. I ask that you do not pass this amendment and that you move this bill forward as it is currently written. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Seeing no one else online, I'm going to close public testimony. We do have one amendment. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment H.1 to SB 54.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment, which apparently was to be well socialized, simply removes all sections of the bill except for the one that is a straight 8-year renewal of the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. Ledge Audit gave them a clean audit, so they're doing a good job, and we received a recommendation that they get a full 8-year renewal. But I still hear some disputes as to whether this is appropriate and some or the best way to accomplish the goals here. So I just would like to consider that maybe we should do renewal separately from making big changes to the board's compositions and duties. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to maintain my objection, having heard from many constituents and many members of the design community that this is a reform that's been worked on for many years in the underlying bill. I don't support gutting the bill. Is there further discussion? Okay, seeing none, will the second, or do you want to wrap
sorry,
up,
yes.
Representative
well,
Sadler?
I'm sorry, I kind of missed, I was just hung up on gutting the bill here. So I would just wrap up that, again, if we want to see this make progress without drag, we should do a straight renewal, and there's still a lot of time left to make these changes and answer questions which exist. So I would continue my motion of the amendment. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Will the Secretary call the roll?
Representative Burke.
No.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Colomb?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall?
No.
Co-Chair Fields?
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
No.
Okay, let's, we'll need to void the roll because Representative Sadler didn't actually vote. Do you mind taking the roll again?
Pass. That's okay.
That's okay.
Are you passing?
I passed, yeah, just because it's 5 o'clock.
Representative Burke.
No.
Representative Carrick.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Cologne.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Co-chair Hall.
No.
Co-chair Fields.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
By a vote of 3-4, Amendment 1 does not pass. At this time, we have processed all amendments. Representative Hall, do you have a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report SB 54, Work Order 34-LS0044-H, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Seeing no objection, House Bill 54 passes from committee. Okay, so that concludes our business today. At 5:07, we're adjourned.